It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The city of Pittsburgh has had 60 mayors in its history, but only one woman has served as the city's top elected leader. That was Sophie Maslow. She died in 2014 at the age of 96, but Pittsburgh author Barbara Burston has written a new biography capturing her life and times. It's titled Sophie, the Incomparable Mayor Maslow. Barbara, welcome to the Confluence.
I'm delighted to be here.
The title of your book, Sophie, was it an obvious choice because everyone just called her Sophie?
It was so obvious, and that's the only name she wanted. She didn't want to be called Mayor Maslow. She wanted to be called Sophie.
Or even Madam Mayor. Whatever people thought of how well she did her job as mayor, why was Sophie so well liked?
I think she always felt that she was one of the people. She wanted it that way, and she was. And she was so personable, so friendly and warm. She would reach out to people on the street. And people just felt that she was a politician who was totally dedicated to public service and to serving everybody. Everybody was under her tent, and she loved that.
How much of that affection was the result of her coming from the neighborhoods? She grew up in the Hill District on Robert Street. Her mother was widowed.
Well, she clearly had a very poor background. She understood the plight of a working person, somebody who was insecure, didn't know what the future held, and she felt it was government's responsibility to really understand that and try to alleviate that situation as best it could.
You tell the story of teenage Sophie walking downtown, paying taxes for her mother at City Hall. Did she ever imagine then that she might be working in that building and working in that building for a long time?
I think she thought about working there, but certainly not as mayor. That was a big stretch for a poor girl growing up and struggling, and but perhaps getting a job working is in some capacity there. But she was the kind of person who really grew in many ways, certainly in her confidence and her abilities. And I think, clearly she decided to run for office when she was well into her 50s.
She developed her passion for politics at an early age. You point out that she was a Democratic committee woman before she could even vote. How big of an influence was Davy Lawrence, that's David L., for those who've only seen his name around town, the longtime mayor of Pittsburgh and, of course, a governor of Pennsylvania?
You have to realize that Sophie had a passion for politics. First of all, for a poor girl, one of the ways out of the ghetto was through political involvement and hopefully leading to a paid job. And politics appealed to her because she also loved people and she loved meeting people and helping people. And so it was a way out of the ghetto, but it also was a way for her to fulfill her own personality and just be the kind of person she wanted to be, which was to help people.
Our guest on The Confluence is author Barbara Burston, who has written a biography of the late Pittsburgh mayor, Sophie Maslow. Barbara, I wanted to talk more about those influences, but first, let's take a listen to Sophie. Speaking with my former WDUQ colleague, Alexandria Chaklos, it was on the 20th anniversary of Sophie becoming mayor in 2008. Sophie was 90 years old at the time.
When did you get your first job with the city?
Well, of course, I began early on. When I was in high school, federal government during the Roosevelt administration built the first public housing project up in Bedford Dwellings. It was the first in the country. And Mrs. Roosevelt dedicated it. And I was there. And I was so impressed with what she did and said that I determined then that I would be a Democrat and work in government.
Well, what made you decide to run for city council?
Actually, I wasn't sure that I wanted to run, but all of the people that I was associated with thought that it was where I should be. And I had a total, I think, of almost 12 years in city council.
They were talking about who would be the next council president. Of course, the council presidency succession to the mayor's office. At that time, did you believe that you had enough confidence then that if something would happen to the mayor that you would step in?
Well, it was an unusual situation. Mayor Kellinger, he was very sick, and I had no idea how sick he was. But he sent for me one day and said, I would like for you to be the council president. It never occurred to me that he was going to die in office. Everybody knew he was sick, but we all thought he would finish the term. I think if I had known that he was going to leave, I would have given it second thoughts because it was frightening. And I believe now when he called me in and told me that he thought I should be council president, he knew what was coming and thought I was the lesser of all the evils.
What went through your mind as you were standing there knowing that I'm going to be the mayor of the city of Pittsburgh?
Well, of course, fright was the first thing. I looked around the room and I thought, how am I going to handle this? But I did.
So when did you decide that I want to run for a full term?
The question arose, I was no kid, the question arose of whether or not I should run for a full term. I had a lot of opposition. As you may recall, I had 4 or 5 men run against me. The men literally insulted me. They said, oh, you can't win. You're going to be a spoiler. Don't do this. But because they said I couldn't do it, I decided to run. And, of course, that's history.
Looking back on all your years in politics, can you think of any stories, any something that maybe makes you chuckle to this day that happened to you?
Oh, there are many, so many. One of the things, of course, that stands out in my mind is we had a private telephone line, of course, and the phone rang, and my secretary was not at the desk, and I picked it up, and the voice at the other end said, this is Bill Clinton. And I said, yes, I'm the Queen of Sheba, and I hung up. It was him. I thought it was some practical joker in the office.
Barbara, as her biographer, what does it do for your heart to hear Mayor Maslov again?
Well, not dealing with the content, just the voice is fun to hear. And I'm just thinking, isn't it interesting that she and Myron Cope were two of the most popular personalities in the city of Pittsburgh at the time, and both of them had these extraordinary voices.
Distinctive.
Distinct, that's a better word.
Sophie was a bit self-deprecating, wasn't she? But when it came to the job, not really.
She was very humble. She always was. And she appreciated being mayor. She always said that she took her job seriously. She never took herself seriously. And that was Sophie. And that was part of her persona.
When she became mayor at age 70, Sophie was a grandmother. You write that she embraced the image of a gentle grandmother. Why do you think she affected that air?
Because she was truthful. She was a grandma. She didn't want any pretense. But she felt as a grandma, the grandmas care about their children, care about people, and she felt that that was not going to harm her image. And you know what? Sophie didn't care about a lot of criticism that she got. Probably the biggest obstacle she felt was being a woman. Mm-hmm. But she didn't have any problem with being a grandmother. And of course, she was a doting grandmother.
Is it fair to say she used that image, a rightful image, in a sense to her advantage because maybe people underestimated her?
Well, certainly, and I mentioned this in the book, that Frank Lucchino and Tom Murphy, when they ran against her, were cautioned that they better go gentle because you just can't criticize a grandma and make it work. So they had a watch their P's and Q's a little bit, although at the end, it was a pretty tough campaign.
Two of the 5 of the candidates, men, who ran against her and lost. I'm Kevin Gavin, talking in studio with author Barbara Burston, who has written a biography of the late Pittsburgh mayor, Sophie Maslov. Sophie mentioned fright and a challenge in that audio we heard. Was the biggest challenge for her the city's poor financial shape when she took over?
Pittsburgh was, the economy was a disaster. As you know, the steel mills were closing. You know, young people were fleeing the cities in order to get jobs. And many other cities around the country and in Pennsylvania were on the verge of bankruptcy or going into serious bankruptcy. And Sophie was determined to make sure that she kept the city afloat. And I think her economic efforts were perhaps her biggest accomplishment. And of course, it ultimately led to the RAD.
Regional Asset District. She was determined to get the Pittsburgh Zoo, Phipps Conservatory, and the Aviary off the city's books. They were part of the budget through the creation of the Regional Asset District. So you think that the RAD was one of her greatest accomplishments?
Well, understand that those three institutions were regional institutions and that most of the visitors to them were people from out of the city, and yet the city was solely responsible for their budget. And this was a huge drain on the city budget. So Sophie started the whole process of trying to get those institutions off the city payroll. She got them to be privatized. And ultimately, she was the one who really, when this RAD proposal was suggested by Rick Stafford at the Allegheny Conference, he went to Sophie and said, Sophie, you got to get this going. This is a great idea that was started in Denver, and we can do it in Pittsburgh if you lead. And she did. And it's extraordinary that she has not gotten credit for an accomplishment that true came at the end of her career. But people have said, without Sophie, we might not have the RAD, which would severely have hurt our cultural, artistic, and sports venues.
Growing up in the Hill, having seen the poverty at the time and then the impact of the building of the Civic Arena, how important was the Crawford Roberts housing development to Sophie?
This was her home. This was her pet project that she really felt had to occur, and was able to, and Jake Malines, who was a representing African American districts, he and she were pals, and together they really were able to promote this. They had funding that had accumulated, and they were able to swing this project, which really was major in terms of the beginning of the rehabilitation of the Hill.
Maslow was a key figure in ending a four-week-long Port Authority bus strike in 1992. Why was she criticized for meddling?
Well, of course, she said that a woman gets criticized for meddling, and she was furious about that because they would never have said that to a man. What happened was that Tom Forster, who was the Allegheny County, one of the commissioners, was in charge of the negotiations, and he was very diligent, but the strike was dragging on. People were suffering. I think there were something like over 300,000 riders who couldn't get into the city, who couldn't get around the city. People couldn't get to their jobs. They couldn't get to their medical appointments. It was really a terrible situation. Sophie was getting bombarded with pleas to do something. And she was able to have the city present something to the judge that the city should get involved in, that hoping that the judge would issue an injunction. And he did issue an injunction, and the strikers went back to work. And she was felt that she had to do this because she had the interests of the public, the welfare at heart, and this was more important to her. So she was accused of meddling, but she was very happy about what happened.
Barbara, you mentioned that Sophie was criticized for not having a vision. If she wasn't a visionary, a dreamer, what was she?
She was a dedicated public service servant who I believe has gotten very short shrift, and who should be recognized as a woman who had the courage to enter a man's world and stand up to the men who criticized her. And, you know, the men have written the history books, and women's role has been kind of given minimum recognition. Sophie was a visionary in that she really wanted for the city the best, and
she wanted Pittsburghers to feel good about their city.
Absolutely. She loved this city.
Barbara Burston is the author of Sophie, the Incredible Mayor Maslow. Barbara, thanks so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
And Barbara's website is sophiemaslow.com. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
Confluence airs weekday mornings from 9 to 10, but the news never stops. Find stories, conversations, and full episodes on our website at wesa.fm/confluence, on Twitter at WESAConfluence, and wherever you get your podcasts. The Confluence continues next on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Maggie Young with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, Three Rivers Stadium in Pittsburgh's north side gets demolished in 2001. Now the site of PNC Park and Heinz Field, it was a multi-purpose facility that could hold nearly 48,000 people for baseball and 59,000 for football. Three Rivers hosted the Pirates, the Steelers, and other Pittsburgh teams. Construction started in 1968, but the field didn't see action until 1970, when the Pirates played their first game there against the Cincinnati Reds on July 17th. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Now in its 32nd season, the reality crime show Cops will feature some familiar faces this evening. Pittsburgh police officers. Public Safety Department spokesperson Chris Tonieri says it's the Bureau's first appearance on the show since 2007. He joins us now. Chris, good morning.
Good morning.
So how did this come about? Did we request they come here? Did they call us? What?
The producer reached out to me and said, we're interested in coming back to Pittsburgh. We've been here before. We always like coming to Pittsburgh. Would you be open to it? I took that request and brought it to the public safety director and Wendell Hisrick and the police chief, Scott Schubert. They were both in favor. We've had positive experiences with cops in the past. So I told him we would be agreeable and they came out over the summer.
So what's the cops team like to work with?
Very easy to work with. They were here for about 8 weeks. They came on some scouting trips first. For them, they like Pittsburgh because our geography is interesting. There's hills, there's water, there's a skyline. The neighborhoods are distinct, so it's visually appealing for them to be here. And since they've been here in the past, they have a good feel for the different neighborhoods and where they want to shoot. They come, and basically in the first week, I go with them to the zones where they're going to be shooting film, and I introduce them to the overnight crews. And basically to the officers and explain, these are the folks from Cops. They're going to be here for 8 weeks. Get used to them because, you know, we have them for 2 months. So that's how it starts. And then they basically just get in a car and go.
And it's for the officers, it's optional whether they want to participate as far as being on camera. Is that correct?
It is. When I introduce the film crew to the officers, I explain to them this has the support of the police chief and the public safety director. However, you're not forced to do this. If you don't want to be on camera, just say so and you won't be on camera.
So when you take them around and introduce them at the different zones, do you get a sense that the cops are fans of Cops?
I think that police officers in general do watch the show or at least appreciate the show because it is a very accurate depiction of what their jobs are like, the daily calls that they go on. It's very mixed in terms of who wants to be on Cops. Mm-hmm. Some have no problem with it. Others are very strongly opposed to it. But then what happens generally is the crews are there for so long that and the officers see that they're not getting in the way, that they're not a problem, and people warm up to them. So people who at first say, no, I don't want to be on the show, maybe at the end of the 8 weeks have changed their mind.
The producers, they obviously edit the footage. Any concern that the final product was an accurate depiction of actually what happened?
No, they've been doing this for 32 years. Basically, they need to present a product, a final product that police are happy with. So they can't, you know, if there's a product that police don't like, that's going to be more difficult the next time around when Cops wants to return.
Mm-hmm. You briefly talked about the officers could sign on or sign off. But what about the privacy concerns, whether it's the officers or the alleged perpetrators, witnesses, what? How's that addressed?
I did speak with a producer yesterday who told me anyone who appears on the show does sign a waiver. They are told you know, that this is footage for the TV show Cops. Pretty much everyone knows what the TV show Cops is now. And if you don't want to be on it, you won't be on it. They were very clear with officers. This is what we do. This is how we do it. This is the waiver. If you sign it, we'll use you. If you don't sign it, we won't use you. As for how they interacted with the public, I don't know. I wasn't on any of the ride-alongs. But I can say that they were very clear with our officers.
Mm-hmm. So that's true for the officers. Some police reality shows have been criticized for not always properly explaining those TV waivers. Some people have been depicted as committing a crime, have said later that they thought those documents were required by the police, that they didn't know that they were optional. So were you worried at all about that?
We've had a good experience with Cops in the past. We look at it from the point of view of it's an opportunity for the Pittsburgh Bureau of Police to showcase the professionalism and skill of our officers. It's also, we look at it as an opportunity for recruiting, to get more people to want to come to Pittsburgh and be police officers. There, in terms of privacy, we felt that they were extremely transparent. They didn't hide anything. Like I said, I wasn't on the road with the crews when they interacted with the public, but in 32 years, Cops has established itself as having a very solid reputation.
Do we know how many or what types of interactions they captured and might be shown tonight?
The one that's tonight, I believe, is about a man who was driving on a suspended license and had been pulled over and cited by police. And within a day or two, that same officer saw the man driving a car without a license and pulled him over again.
Any amusing ones that you found particularly interesting?
The one that the producers were very happy with was there was a call for a kitten in a car engine. And so you have two officers responding to very concerned citizens, and you can hear the cat meowing, and they open the hood and reach in, and you know, they are able to rescue a kitten. And that's the type of story that I think is one reason why police officers are a fan of the TV show Cops, because that's the type of stuff that police do on a regular basis.
And the producers liked that one?
Yes, they did, very much.
Okay. And briefly, anything off limits?
No. Well, the only thing that was off limits is people who didn't want to be on TV. If you signed a waiver, you could be on. If you didn't sign the waiver, you wouldn't be on.
Mm-hmm. This evening's premiere of this episode, will the Bureau be in future episodes as well from this filming?
Yeah, there will be several episodes this spring. I think that they came away with about six different stories. So, yeah, throughout the spring, they will be featured in Cops.
Finally, are you excited to watch tonight? Nervous, both, top brass, have they already gotten a preview?
Yes, everyone has gotten a preview. I'm not nervous. I'm excited.
Okay. Chris Tonieri is the Public Information Officer for Pittsburgh Public Safety Department. Thanks so much, Chris.
Thanks for having me.
And Bureau of Police will be featured on this evening's episode of Cops. That's tonight at 10 on the Paramount Network. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Cancel culture. By now, it's a familiar cycle. A public figure says or does something offensive, and a groundswell of people call for them to be reprimanded, boycotted, or shunned. Often it's liberals calling out supposed bad behavior, and conservatives disparaging those liberals as ultra-sensitive. In the first story in our Embedded 2020 series, Keystone Crossroads' Jen Kinney spent some time with some unlikely champions of cancel culture. Two Trump voters from rural Pennsylvania on a mission to hold people accountable for racism.
Hello, Mr. Paul.
Mr. Barrow, how are you?
I am fine, sir.
In Schuylkill County, firehouses are like a cross between a church basement and a sports bar. They're communal, civic, sometimes they have secret knocks. On this Sunday afternoon, we're at the bar with Andy Barrow.
I'm going to go with the PBR, the hair of the dog.
He comes to catch up with friends, play darts.
Another thing we do here is we roll the dice, so let's see if I get anything. Okay, nothing.
This is my brother, Stosh.
Stosh Webb, Andy's younger brother.
My brother Andy, he's the older, wiser. He always looked out for me, took care of me, gave me sound advice.
Cheers, bro.
Andy is 52. Stosh is 44. And they have a lot in common. Both are combat veterans, both lean conservative, both grew up here in Schuylkill County, mountainous, working class, coal country, where the population is 95% white. And there's one pretty big difference between the brothers. Stosh is black, Andy and their other brother are white. First, Andy.
I didn't know my biological father. My mother remarried when I was in first grade, and my mother married a black man. So in this area, that was a little bit controversial at the time, to say the least.
You know, nobody really said anything until once I get high school and teenager and stuff like that. And they're like, wait a minute, you have two white brothers? I'm like, yeah.
The social quarters of the Deer Lake Fire Company, where the brothers are nursing a hangover, was one of the first places their parents felt accepted as a couple. These halls are important around here. They raise money to support the volunteer firefighting. Some are voting locations.
They do bingos and kids' night, like movie nights.
The brothers are regulars at half a dozen fire halls around the county. Everyone seems to know them. But they're feuding with one fire company because of something that Stosh says happened last year.
I was out with my two buddies. One was Caucasian, the other one was Asian.
They were drinking, playing music on the jukebox at a social club in nearby Port Clinton.
So the bartender walks up. He's like, why don't you look up Lover by David Allan Cole? And we're like, excuse me? He's like, yeah, Lover, look it up.
That bleeped word, that was a racial slur said by a white bartender to a black patron.
I'm like, wow, that word just rolls off your tongue like you said it before.
David Allan Coe is a country musician who's recorded some very obscene, very offensive songs. In this one, a white man sings about how disgusted he is that his ex is now with a black man. It's graphic, racist, misogynistic.
We're kind of, you know, shocked, kind of taking, like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Like, what even makes you think it's okay to say that? And in the meantime, the fire chief was sitting off to the right. He didn't say anything. We got up and left.
Stosh filed a complaint. He's no stranger to racism and ignorance. Most of the time, he shrugs it off with dry humor. But this crossed a line. He called Andy.
Andy feels more strongly about it than I do. Like, I can only push it so far.
Andy's hit his own limit. He's tired of other white people assuming that just because he's white and conservative, he'll tolerate bigoted comments. Tired of the conversations white people sometimes have when his brother and father aren't in the room. Like recently, when some guys at a fire company bar were shouting slurs at black athletes on TV. And then
my dad came in. My dad, who's black. And these are people who are friends with my dad. But then 5 minutes later, when he walks out the door, they're back to dropping the N-bomb. Look at this blank on the TV. I don't understand the psychology of it.
So after the jukebox incident, Andy wrote a letter to the local paper.
Letter to the editor. Amidst the national debate over whether or not politicians or their comments are racist, I've encountered a clear example of racism which leaves no room for conjecture.
My only expectation is this guy, this bartender, should not be in this position in a fire company that is a pseudo-civic organization that is supported a lot of times by taxpayer dollars. I got it. It's his First Amendment right, freedom of speech. Blah, blah, blah. But there's repercussions with that.
The leadership of the Port Clinton Fire Company would not comment for this story. They did suspend the bartender, Michael Burke, for 2 weeks. Even though Stosh's friends confirmed they witnessed the incident, when reached by phone, Burke said it never happened.
We're only dealing with some idiot here that's writing letters and causing trouble. The guy's a bully and an idiot.
But it's been 6 months and the brothers aren't backing down. They want Burke fired. But when they posted about the incident in a local Facebook group, the brothers got a lot of support and a lot of pushback. So many snowflakes upset by a word, one person commented. Everybody's always offended by something.
You're sitting here looking at two guys who have how many combat tours? We are very thick-skinned individuals, trust me on that. I have never been called a snowflake before.
That's the thing about cancel culture. Critics say so-called social justice warriors want too much too fast, punishment with no room for second chances. But to the brothers, this is just the worst incident in decades of casual racism. Now that they feel a hard line has been crossed, they can't believe their community doesn't have their back. Stosh hasn't returned to Port Clinton. Andy does, but mostly to be provocative.
Everybody around here just wants this to go away. No, no. Yeah, it's easy for you to say that. You ain't me. This ain't your brother.
The brothers try not to pay too much mind to national politics. Andy had to ask his daughter what snowflake meant. They both voted for Obama in 08. Stosh went for Romney in 2012. And then?
I'll be honest with you, I voted for Trump. It was a lesser of two evils.
Stosh voted for Trump, too. Both men say they like what he's done for the economy, but not a lot of the other things he said and done.
Lacks a little bit of dignity, I think.
But I mean, you both told me you might vote for him again. I mean, it seems like holding this bartender to a higher standard than the president.
Well, I never heard the president use that word. Okay. I don't know that I've seen him do anything inherently racist. The issue here is this is something tangible to us. This is like this table in front of me. This is personal, but we can touch this.
I mean, everybody has their line. Like it's close with him. Like it's like that drunk uncle. Like, oh man, I'm gonna talk to this guy, but he's gonna give me $100 bills for Christmas. So, thanks, Uncle Donald. Yeah,
because we're those drunk uncles.
Looking at the Democrats in the primary, both brothers say Joe Biden is the only one they could vote for over Trump. Andy says he's the only one who can appeal to normal Americans. And then he wonders, what does he mean by normal American? Is that a racist way to think? For Keystone Crossroads, I'm Jen Kinney.
Keystone Crossroads Embedded 2020 Project is election year coverage that puts people, not politicians, at the center. You can find more at whyy.org/embedded2020. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Many people on the autism spectrum experience hypersensitivities, an over-responsiveness to a wide range of stimuli, from sights and sounds to smells and touch. Yesterday, the Carnegie Science Center held its first sensory-sensitive science hours of the year so that people on the spectrum could better enjoy their visit. Joining us in studio is Program Manager Justin Tognery. Justin, welcome to The Confluence.
Hi, it's great to be here.
More organizations in the region are adding, adapting their activities to make them sensory friendly, from the Children's Museum to the Pittsburgh Ballet to the airport. What made the Science Center want to create its own sensory spaces?
Sure. Yeah. If you've ever visited the Science Center, you know it's very ultra sensitive or sensory overload, with rockets shooting in the air and robots singing and basketball arms shooting hoops. And so we wanted to provide, one of the overarching goals of the museum is being accessible for all visitors. And so what we wanted to do is for people who have that sensory sensitivity, set up an environment where they feel safe and it's set up for them to visit the museum, you know, like everybody else.
Right. Who did you work with to make the Science Center and specific activities more accessible, more enjoyable?
Yeah, starting off, we don't necessarily have all the expertise to provide it. So we wanted to work with community partners. We worked with Pittsburgh Center for Autistic Advocacy. We worked with Autism Connections of Pennsylvania. And then we also worked with Evolve Coaching to do just walkthroughs of different exhibits, what the different sensory overload areas would be and how we would adjust them.
All right. The Science Center is such an interactive place, built really to appeal to the senses. So how do you make the space more friendly to those with these sensitivities?
Sure. So we do a lot of exhibit modifications throughout the museum. We set up a quiet area for folks during that time. We make adjustments to our demonstration theater shows as well as our planetarium, and then we make sound and light adjustments in our theater as well. So it's a lot of doing just sound adjustments as well as light adjustments. We might be turning off exhibits. We might just be turning them down, whatever the case may be.
What sort of turnout did you get yesterday?
So Sundays are typically a little bit slower this time of year, but yesterday we had, it was one of the busier Sundays of the year so far. We opened up at 9 o'clock yesterday, which is a little bit different than 10 a.m., and we had about 100 visitors come in that hour. So it was a pretty good turnout in that first hour.
Feedback, informal or whatever. What was the buzz about? Any favorites?
Yeah, so a lot of the feedback we get is anecdotal from talking with visitors, but some of the feedback that we've gotten is just parents thanking us because they wouldn't have been able to come to the museum before, and so setting up these special sensory hours has allowed them to come to the museum, enjoy a more quieter area, less sensory overload, and we had one parent who really just said this was the best time of the year, this was the best visit they've ever had because their daughter was able to take part in more things than typically they would have otherwise because they've gotten scared with some of the sensory sounds that happen at the museum.
Less than 2 minutes left. So was there a favorite of the visitors yesterday, would you say?
Yeah, so the best thing, I think, the best exhibit is our miniature railroad and village, and they set up a tactile table outside of the exhibit. So they take pieces off of the railroad and put it on a table so people can touch those, so some tactile pieces. So right. Yeah, that was popular.
All right. So you mentioned sort of informal feedback, however they get it, relay it to staff or whatever, or maybe you're doing a little eavesdropping on people as they're leaving. Do you take any of those suggestions and sort of fine-tune the experiences for the next show, the next time that you do have a Sunday series?
Yeah, we take it to heart. Like I said, we want to make the most accessible environment for folks. And so we work with our internal accessibility group. We look at the feedback and think with those area managers what adjustments we can make.
And have you gotten any such feedback from the visitors so that you can do it?
Yeah, we have a lot of the feedback is exhibit based on, you know, we try to keep as much on as possible, but pieces that are left on, some visitors may have feedback that they don't want that on or it's causing some overload. So we take that and we just make adjustments to those exhibits for the next time.
Well, speaking of next time, we have about 30 seconds left. Do you plan to expand hours programming?
Yeah, so we have the next program April 26th, and then we have one May 17th, and then we'll have them quarterly for the rest of the year. It's been a really popular program, so we want to continue it as you know, it's been really well received by the community.
And that April 26th was actually an addition, wasn't it?
Yeah, we added that in collaboration with Autism Speaks because they're doing an Autism Awareness Day at the Pittsburgh Pirate Game. And so we're collaborating with them to host one in the morning.
Justin Tognorin is a sensory sensitive program manager at the Carnegie Science Center. Thanks for coming in.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together. Next time, what are local media getting right and wrong when covering stories about the city's African-American communities? We'll preview a panel discussion about how bias, erasure, and quality of life reflects what we share about our Black neighbors. Plus, what it takes to improve care, convenience, and access for veterans through online personal health management. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, production assistants from Caldwell Halden and Caroline Burke. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.